this, and now Professor Susan James will have the opportunity to provide a response to these interesting comments.
Yes, well, thank you. This is indeed an overwhelming set of comments to respond to, and I'd like, first of all, to thank you, all three of you, for your enormous generosity in reading the book and saying such nice things about it, but also, more than that, really, reading it so carefully and thoughtfully. I'm really deeply honoured, and especially grateful to Demetris for organising this whole occasion. Perhaps I can take the three sets of comments in turn and start by going back to what Jenny was saying. I think if I can try to summarise Jenny's view, her worry is that I sort of try to collapse too much or merge too much what Spinoza has to say about true religion understood as a sort of imaginative discourse where, as well, people imagine, the prophets imagine themselves as the recipients of divine revelation, and people imagine themselves as living in the sorts of ways of life that prophecy makes possible, that I merge that too much with what Spinoza calls philosophy, that's to say a sort of rational understanding of who we are and how we ought to live, which is governed not by the desire to create cohesive and articulate ways of life where we can all live peacefully and securely together, but is governed by the desire for truth. That the point of religion is just to kind of get along and live all right. The point of philosophy is to understand the world and ourselves as we really are. And I say, and I think I agree with Jenny's interpretation of me, as it were, I say that there are two sorts of religion involved here, that Spinoza wants to see, of course, what we ordinarily take to be religious discourse as a form of religion, and he identifies what it is to live piously within that kind of discourse, which, as he thinks of it, is to live in accordance with the divine law, that's to say, to love God and love your neighbour. So what piety is about in true religion is about creating together a way of life in which we can love our neighbours, or, as I put it in the book, just live cooperatively together. And Jenny thinks that that's sort of all right, and that that's a kind of diagnosis of religion which Spinoza can give from a rational perspective which stands outside religion itself. But that if you try to extend the notion of piety and apply it to philosophy itself and think of philosophy as a kind of piety, then you begin to get into trouble. And I think Jenny wants to say there are two things that get you into trouble. One is that it's not quite clear what piety means in the context of philosophy. And the other is that thinking that there is some sense of piety in the case of religion breaks down a distinction between revelation, which is something imaginative that belongs to religion, and philosophy, which is something rational, unimaginative, which has no space for revelation. And I think that in response, I want to acknowledge that I think this is a very, very tricky area, and I'm, you know, perfectly happy to think that I haven't got it completely right. But I'd like to sort of try to put my point by separating out revelation and piety. There is this weird moment at the beginning of the TTP when Spinoza says, look, people normally think that revelation only belongs in the domain of religion and prophecy and so on, but really you could say just as well that when we reason, God reveals himself to us. Because after all, what do we get? We get knowledge of God. And so revelation, as it were, seems to be, as Spinoza says at the beginning, sure knowledge. There are these two ways of getting sure knowledge. You can get it through the special insights of prophecy, and you can get it through reasoning. And I think that Jenny's right to think that there is something a bit tense about that, and that Spinoza is sort of stretching a point. He's making a polemical point and saying, look, I mean, you think you've got a monopoly, you theologians think you've got a monopoly on revelation, but you haven't really. I mean, you could think about revelation like this as well. You could think of it as something that philosophers also have. And I'm not sure really how much he wants to press that point. It's not something that he particularly comes back to. It may be just a sort of sparring point that he makes in the process of the argument. But it does seem to me that if you think about... I'd like to just say, okay, well, let's put that point about revelation aside and say, yes, that's equivocal. But now let's return to the notion of piety and try and, as it were, kind of treat that a bit separately from revelation, which I think is how it goes in the text. So I can concede, I mean, I'm sort of happy to concede to, I don't want to entirely concede to you, Jenny, on revelation, but I don't want to make a big deal about whether philosophy is revealed. I do want to make more of a big deal about whether Spinoza sees philosophy as it were, giving us a kind of piety. And there I think he does want a continuity. He wants to say, what is piety? Piety is, as it were, managing to live in accordance with the divine law, managing to live, as it were, in the light of an understanding of the way the world is organized and the natural laws that govern it. And I think he wants to say that, as well, religion does that in one way. The prophets provide us with insights about how to live, which are very special, and which the rest of, well, which religious communities can benefit from. But that philosophy provides us with even surer and clearer knowledge of how we ought to live. And that, as it were, managing to do that, having that insight, living like that, is what piety consists in. And I think that there's a moment in the Ethics where Spinoza makes this point pretty clearly in section 4, proposition 37, where he says, the desire to do good generated by living according to the guidance of reason, so the desire to do good that comes from understanding things philosophically and living in the light of that understanding, I call piety. And so I think he is wanting to use the notion of piety more flexibly, and that doesn't really seem to me too strange if you're Spinoza and you think that God and nature are the same thing. I mean, so I think I do want to press that point, that there are those two angles of coming, two angles by which one can come at the project of, as it were, living according to... of wanting to do good. You can want to do good, live piously, live in accordance with the divine law from the perspective of imagination. And I think you can also do that, as Spinoza says, from the guidance of reason as a philosopher. So that I want to say that there's a kind of continuity between the project of living piously in a kind of explicitly religious, as we would ordinarily say, imaginative mould, and learning to live more piously as you acquire a greater rational grasp of things. But I think that's a tremendously interesting set of comments, and I'm not, you know, I'm very open to suggestion here, criticism indeed, and I don't suppose I've satisfied you, Jenny.
No, the book is very persuasive, as I say. It's unsettling to be quite such a persuasive case.
Well, I hope we can talk a bit more if people want to. Now, Michael's points are very complicated, I think, and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to sort of get them exactly straight. So, Michael, you'll have to help me out if I don't. But I think that your comments actually as it were, bear, or they fit together rather well with Jenny's comments, because at least the first of your comments is to the effect that I make a mistake in saying that, as it were, sort of religion and reason are in pursuit of the same ends, and you want to say that they're only in pursuit of overlapping ends. I don't completely disagree with that, and I think that the context in which I am raising that point is where I'm talking about a sort of continuity, as I see it, between religion and philosophy, which builds on this point. I mean, I think that I do think more than other people, and probably more than you, that there is a continuity, as Spinoza sees it, between the project of learning to live in the way that he describes as truly religious, that's to say, learning to live cooperatively together, and learning to reason. I think that they are, that the ends of these two projects don't completely coincide, and that Michael's absolutely right to pull me up about that, but that nevertheless there is a strong continuity between them. It looks as though there isn't a continuity because Spinoza says, look, what's religion for? It's just for, as it were, learning to get on, learning to live together. It has nothing to do with truth, whereas philosophy is all about truth. But I think that some of the requirements that he imposes on true religion are actually requirements that, as it were, at least put people in the way of learning to reason, and to some extent do require the sort of materials of reasoning, so that there's a very smooth, well, there is a transition of sorts anyway from religion to philosophy. And I think one can see that particularly clearly. I mean, if you think of the requirements of what it is to live religiously for Spinoza, which, as Michael says, don't really have all that much, or, I mean, they only have a sort of overlapping amount to do with what we normally associate with religion. So when you learn to live religiously, you learn to live cooperatively with other people, to love your neighbour, as Spinoza sort of sums it up. And part of that, I think, is learning, as Spinoza actually says, to avoid obstinacy. You have to learn to negotiate with people, to get on with them, to find a way of life, a sort of modus vivendi that you can all manage. And in doing that, one of the things that you have to do is to take people seriously as reasoners who have certain ideas, who invest in their ideas, who take them seriously, and who require you to, they require you to recognize that fact about them and take them seriously. So that living cooperatively is, among other things, learning not to be obstinate, not to sort of insist on your own ideas or your own beliefs or your own habits and whatever you've grown up with in the face of people who challenge them. And it seems to me that that skill, the requirement that you should do your best to try to learn to avoid obstinacy, as Spinoza puts it, is, as it were, part of what's involved in learning to live rationally. It's learning to be open, as Spinoza says, to other people and their views, and to critical assessment of your own position. And I think that there's a kind of quite easy transition from that description of what's involved in a religious way of life to some of the things that Spinoza says at the end of the TTP about people who are rational, where he says, you know, that they have a kind of zeal for truth, but that they are, I've forgotten the words exactly, you know, they are sort of kindly and open and things of that sort, so that I find there that transition there too. So I think that thank you for, you know, pulling me up about the lack of overlap, but I do think that there's a great deal of continuity there as well, so that one can sort of see this problem of the relationship between religion and philosophy sort of, you know, constantly the glass shifts a little bit. I agree with you about ceremonies. I mean, I agree with you that ceremonies sort of seem to be part of religious life and not an intrinsic part of a philosophical life. Although, you know, one can imagine philosophers who might have their own kinds of ceremonial practices, as they do. I think that the point you make about there was a point about Moses, wasn't it, where you say that I'm sort of stuck between two different interpretations of the ceremonial law. On the one hand, I say, you know, that Moses seems to impose a ceremonial law which kind of removes from people the capacity to think creatively for themselves about the law. It just kind of tells them in every aspect of their life, you know, this is what you have to do. And you want to say, Michael, I think that isn't quite right, because there's a problem there about whether Moses is sovereign or really whether the people are sovereign, as it were. Who is the author of this ceremonial law? Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really wonderful and terribly tricky political point in Spinoza's work, and here I'm sort of shifting ground a bit to his more political views, I think, because Spinoza does seem to say that throughout the Hebrew Republic, I mean, it was a republic, the people were ultimately the sovereign. And yet the sense in which the people are the sovereign is tremendously opaque. It's a sort of symbolic sovereignty, because who actually calls the shots? Well, it, you know, it doesn't really seem to be the people. First it seems to be Moses, and then it seems to be, you know, various combinations of principes and priests and so on and so forth. And according to Spinoza, the republic only finally collapses when the Hebrews come to be ruled by kings. And I think that this is a kind of a general ambiguity about early modern theories of early modern republicanism, about just kind of what it really means to say the people are sovereign. So I agree that Spinoza sort of in a way wants to say the people are sovereign all along, but they're only sovereign in the most peculiar fashion in the founding of the Hebrew Republic, because, as it were, they take themselves to hand over their power to God, and they don't succeed because God isn't the sort of being who can be a ruler. And so really, although they don't know it, they themselves are the sovereign. And then everybody who comes after is just their representative rather than really actually the sovereign. So that they are the authors of the law, but at the same time, kind of in practical life, they don't seem to be the authors of the law. It looks as though it's Moses who actually tells them kind of what to do and organizes their life. Though, of course, Michael might go on to say, and this would be completely right, that that Spinoza will say, in any republic, power is really a kind of balance between whoever is, as it were, exercised, whoever is the, you know, the maker of the law and the people. And so that's certainly true in that case. And so they must, as it were, have some role in vindicating and upholding the kind of republic that they maintain. So I think, Michael, I don't deeply disagree with you that there are, but perhaps I do. You'll have to tell me in a minute. Dimitri, so thank you for this kindness. I think that this point about the relationship between method and argument is very interesting. And I suppose what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is that, you know, it seems to me that in the TTP, Spinoza is juggling a whole sequence of voices, as it were. Sometimes he's speaking in the voice of reason, sometimes in the voice of imagination, sometimes with this audience, sometimes with that audience in mind. And so that the work is kind of, if you like, agonistic throughout. But that seems to me completely right. The point about there being no outside the law. I find myself... I think I sort of agree with you and I sort of don't. I mean, there is a sense, of course, in which nothing for Spinoza can be outside the law, because the law of nature is absolutely all-encompassing. But I think perhaps that I think more than you, that there is a sense in which one can be outside the civil law, and that there are states of nature in Spinoza where you're not outside the law of nature, of course, but you are outside the civil law. So I guess I read Spinoza as a bit more Hobbesian than you do. And I certainly read his account of the founding of the Jewish state as one where, so we do, as he says, have a group of people who are in a state of nature. They're under the authority of Moses, you said, but I think that I'm not so sure about that, because Spinoza elsewhere in the text talks about the ways in which states are formed, and he says, you know, there are sort of basically two good ways to do it, and one is to form a democracy, and the other is to take some charismatic leader and be ruled by them. So I take it that what's happening is that Moses is being elevated as a kind of charismatic leader in a way that gets us into all the complexities that I've just talked about in relation to Michael, but that there is definitely an outside, as it seems to me, there is an outside the law in the civil sense. So, you know, so I think I do read Spinoza as a much more Hobbesian thinker than you do, and that and it seems to me there's a kind of strong analogy between the way that Spinoza wants to think of the state of nature, you know, which may or may be more or less real, as it were, but it's certainly a kind of a construct that you can think with. And it's a condition for him, as for Hobbes, in which there are no, as it were, normative categories. They all have to be no moral categories anyway, and no juridical categories, and that they really have to be created by groups of people who make the law, I mean, who make all the moral law and the civil law. So there I think that we differ a bit, but it doesn't seem to me that my view neglects the claim that, as well, what a right is power. I mean, I think that I completely agree with you that for Spinoza and for Hobbes too, in the state of nature, what right is just the power that you have, that you can exercise, and that what goes on in the transition to the state is the creation of rights that, as it were, don't just work in that way, which have stability, which have moral content, and so on. They too are powers, they have to be created. So you don't abandon this idea that rights are powers, but there's no conflict there, as I see it. So thank you all very, very much for these deep comments.